Dispatches from the car.
Mama Africa.
Mama Africa.
Audio reports from the World Social Forum 2011 in Dakar, Senegal. Produced for broadcast on campus community radio stations globally. In this segment of Dispatches from Dakar, we will hear a presentation by author Naomi Klein, given in Dakar, Senegal, focusing on climate justice struggles globally and the importance of confronting state and corporate attempts at geoengineering the planet in the face of climate change. Klein speaks about contemporary climate catastrophes, such as the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, as a tipping point on environmental destruction, and the importance of the upcoming climate justice mobilization in Durban, South Africa, protesting the UN-backed climate conference in November-December 2011.
Mama Africa.
Mama Africa.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you, Pat. I'm really in debt to the fantastic work of the Etc. Group. Those of you who are not familiar with their work and are learning about it here for the first time, I hope you will delve deeper into it. Go to their website, download their reports. They're doing incredible popular education, and I've learned a lot from them. You know, when you listen to Pat speak, it's always a little alarming. I think a lot of us here probably believe that we understand the ambitions and the depths of the colonization of public space, of the privatization of our world, and then we learn about all of these new frontiers out there. But this is not science fiction. This is really happening. And as part of my research for this project, I've been going to gatherings of the scientists and policymakers who are taking this very seriously indeed. And after the collapse in Copenhagen, we've really seen an acceleration of this, because even the governments that are, like the U.S. government, that are very proud, supposedly, of what happened in Copenhagen and touting the joys of the Copenhagen Accord, what they do know is that it in no way averts climate chaos. And so they are actively pursuing this so-called Plan B behind closed doors. And you really see a causal relationship between the political failure to deal with climate change and this acceleration of the embrace of technologies like geoengineering and these ideas like pouring sulfur into the stratosphere in order to dim the sun. It's a kind of a new dark age that they are trying to impose on us. So this gathering is about Rio, and many of you may have heard this story, many of you may not. It may be an apocryphal story, but there was a big debate at the first Rio summit about whether or not then President George Bush Sr. would attend the Earth Summit, and it was touch and go there for a while, but at the very last minute he did go. But he said in an interview something that has been repeated over and over. He said, "We're here, we want to be involved in these negotiations, but I want to make one thing clear, and that's that the American way of life is not up for negotiation." And I think it's really important for us to understand that in the 20 years since, that has been the case. That has been the underlying logic, and not only has the American way of life not been up for negotiation, but those 20 years have seen a rapid acceleration of the globalization of the so-called American way of life. And what is that American way of life? It is based on the idea that there will always be more. That is at the very heart of what is sometimes called the American dream. The idea of endless, constant growth, that there will always be a new frontier. As soon as you reach one limit, you will be able to transcend it. And that's sort of, you know, who Sarah Palin is in the world, right? She's easy to laugh at, but she came onto the political stage at this moment, actually, when people were realizing that they had hit these ecological limits. You know, polar bears were on the cover of Newsweek magazine. And then along comes Sarah Palin, and she says, "Well, there's this wonderful, magical place called Alaska." This is another frontier, and you can come up and drill, baby, drill. You remember that moment. And so this is just a telling and a retelling of the narrative that is really at the heart of Western culture, that is at the heart of the colonization of the Americas, of every colonial project, a new frontier. And sometimes the frontiers are physical frontiers, like Alaska, but more often now they are technological frontiers that tell us that we will be able to overcome the physical limits with these new technologies. But it's this expansionist logic and the logic that is at the heart of the scientific revolution, articulated probably best by Francis Bacon, that it is that man, and they did mean men, were apart from nature, apart from women, and had the capacity to put nature into constraints, and this is the famous Francis Bacon quote, and make it new by the art and the hand of man. And interestingly enough, Francis Bacon's writings and ideas inspired the creation of the Royal Society in the 1600s in Britain, and now the Royal Society is the primary champion and the most powerful and most credible champion of the idea that we can fix the planet, fix the sky through technology, through geoengineering. I say all of this because I think it's important that we understand that we are in the midst not just of a political and ecological crisis, but also of a narrative crisis. We find ourselves locked in a narrative loop. We've told ourselves these same stories about our ability to dominate each other, our ability to dominate the planet, and also that no matter what happens, we will be saved. I mean, this is at the heart of so many biblical myths, you know, get yourself into enough trouble and an ark will come along and take you and your friends away, or there will be a rapture and you will be brought to the new Jerusalem in the sky. So in other words, you don't have to deal with the effects of your actions. There's always an escape hatch. And so there's something strange about these sci-fi solutions that Pat talks about, and it's interesting that we use the word sci-fi because, of course, we have imagined this future so many times in Hollywood movies and science fiction books that it's almost as if it's happened already. It has an air of inevitability about it, and that is the power of story, the stories that we've been locked into. So I think as we look forward to Rio, I think we need to understand the depths of the challenge that we face, that when we challenge these technologies, we really are challenging the stories at the center of Western culture, what we call civilization. And in a sense, it precipitates a crisis to challenge these technologies, because even though they seem really far out there, you know, synthetic biology, you know, reflecting the sun back to space, fertilizing the oceans, the truth is that they fit perfectly within our current economic, social, and cultural paradigms. This is what we do. We dominate nature. We use our ingenuity to fix any problem. We overcome any limits. We always find a new frontier. So even if we have an initial feeling of, whoa, there's something wrong with that, the only thing that we have to do in order to bring on the reality that Pat has just laid out is nothing, is just to sort of go limp and let it happen, because all the momentum of our society is propelling us towards that future. It is what we do, only more so, right? Only more extreme. So that's the bad news, is that this is the story, and this is the logical conclusion of the story that we've been telling ourselves for so long. And we have been manufacturing landscapes on a massive scale. You know, I live in Canada, the tar sands are visible from space. It's the largest industrial project in the world. It is not oil drilling. It is the skinning of the earth. The tar sands cover an area as large as England. So we are already engaged in a process of dramatically changing the earth. And so all we're talking about when we talk about colonizing the sky and doing that deliberately, it is just more of the same. But that said, there is there is a different quality to it. But before I move on there, I think one of the things that's striking about it is that the similarities in the logic of how we are talk about climate change and how we're proposing to fix it through technology. This idea of fixing the sky, the idea of reflecting the sun's rays back, assumes that the Earth's climate systems are simple enough that we could treat the Earth as if it had a thermostat attached to it, and when it gets too hot, you can just turn down the temperature. And that, of course, assumes that climate change is just a temperature problem, that it isn't part of a broader ecological crisis and a part of a broader pattern where we're hitting all kinds of ecological limits, not just the limits of the atmosphere to absorb the carbon that we're putting into it, but the limits of the ocean to absorb the stresses of overfishing, or of our soil to absorb the pressures of industrial farming, or of our aquifers to sustain the pressures that we're putting on them and the pollutants that we're putting into them. These are all interconnected, and in some ways climate is only the most visible, the most dramatic, and the scariest, but they're all interconnected. But so instead we just treat it as if it's a temperature problem, so we can just turn down the temperature. But that, in a way, is the arrogance with which our governments are treating the climate crisis right now, because we act as if we have the ability to control. You know, how much are we going to are we going to allow temperatures to increase? 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, 3 degrees. These are the arrogant discussions that take place in Copenhagen and Cancun, and that will take place in Durban in a few months. The assumption being that we have that kind of control. Of course, we don't have that kind of control. All we know, based on the science, is that we need to do a U-turn now and radically reduce our emissions. The idea that we could allow the temperature to increase just a little bit, but turn it down and stop it before things get really bad, and that we wouldn't be overwhelmed by tipping points, is pure fantasy. And it isn't coming from the climate scientists. It's coming from the economists with very little knowledge of the science, imposing their mechanistic thinking on the climate science and their illusions of control that have failed so spectacularly in the realm of economics, and now applying it to climate, which is quite terrifying. So my point is that we already act as if the Earth has a thermostat, and now we're just taking it to a more literal realm. So the bad news is these technologies, this Earth grab, is just more of what we've already been doing. We've already privatized everything we can think of. Now we're seeing new frontiers that we didn't even know existed. We already act as if we can have control over systems that are vastly more complex than we're able to control. The good news is that somewhere inside of us, as we go into this more extreme realm of re-engineering the building blocks of life, changing the sky, changing the ocean deliberately, something inside us rebels. And what we see is that people's first reactions, and I'm not just talking about people at the World Social Forum, generally, people's first reaction to hearing about geoengineering is, no, there's something wrong with that. You know, you're playing God. You shouldn't do that. So actually, it's work to overcome an instinct, an instinct of self-preservation, a memory of another relationship to nature. And these technologies awaken that in us, awaken that. And that is something that I think that we need to build on as we think about how we get off this course. Because I don't think we get off this course just by saying no. I think we get off this course by recognizing these stories that we are trapped in and trying to think of the kinds of stories that we need to tell, that we need to weave, that can inspire us to evolve, to change our way of life, so that it isn't leading us towards this future that actually, when we hear described, frightens us, terrifies us. And I do believe that Rio provides an opportunity for us to engage in this new kind of collective storytelling. I think about why people have that sort of instant fear, that instant cringe when they hear about these technologies. I think it has to do with the fact that there is something inside so many of us that longs for wild places or places that we actually haven't already colonized with our technology, with our pollution, that we haven't already left our imprint on. And so the idea that we would do this to space, that we would do this to the stratosphere, that we would do this to the sky, is very frightening. And I was in Louisiana shortly after the oil rig exploded and sank, and the waters were just filled with oil last June. And I actually flew over the ground zero of the disaster site. And this was the point where, you know, you've all seen the images where the ocean was just striped. It looked like it was bleeding. The Gulf looked like it was bleeding. There were these massive stripes of oil, and they were red, sort of rusty red. But when you had that sort of aerial view and looking down on it, I was in a Coast Guard plane. You know, it was oil till the horizon. And what was most disturbing about it was just this feeling of claustrophobia. Like, you don't realize until you're confronted with it the extent to which you count on there being places like the open ocean that seem in some way to be too vast to be changed by our behavior. But then suddenly you look at the open ocean and it looks like the bottom of, you know, a garage. It looks like the bottom of an auto repair shop with puddles everywhere. And you realize actually we have gone that far. And that's, I think, why geoengineering is so frightening and why we need to articulate what it is about it that's frightening. And because it's a healthy fear. It's some kind of an instinct that's being awakened in us. And like I said, I think that it evokes a cultural memory of a time before the scientific revolution, even in European culture, when the Earth was considered sacred. You know, we often talk about this being something that only indigenous people understand and believe, that the Earth is sacred. And we forget that before the scientific revolution, every culture in the world believed that the Earth was their mother, the giver of life, and that we needed to stand in awe of those forces and see them as sacred. And so when these technologies push us beyond our comfort zone, something, we remember something about those about our past, about who we were and who we might be again. The environmental movement, the big green environmental movement, I think is a huge part of the problem here. And you know, when I was in Copenhagen for the climate summit, a lot of people compared it to Rio and the Earth Summit. I know a lot of people here were in Copenhagen, and one of the things that really struck me about that space was it in no way felt like a gathering about the Earth, even though there were globes everywhere. Everywhere you looked in Copenhagen, you would just see like a giant Earth, right? And everywhere in the conference center, there were all of these globes. And I started to think, actually, that this is part of the problem, that the symbol of the modern environmental movement has been that image of the Earth taken from space, from the Apollo. And you know, it's sometimes credited with giving birth to the modern environmental movement, that we saw this fragile blue planet from space and realized that we had to protect it. But I'm actually starting to think that this astronaut's eye view of the planet is really quite damaging. Because I think if you're just looking at the Earth from space and you have a problem like climate change that you're confronted with, then I think ideas, technological fixes, start to make more sense. And the idea that all the false solutions that we've been talking about of just sort of moving around the right to pollute, carbon credits, makes sense. If you have this astronaut's eye view from space, instead of looking at it from ground level. And so, you know, for instance, you'll have big environmental groups saying that natural gas is a clean fossil fuel. It's a good transition fossil fuel. And people on the ground who are actually dealing with this technology are saying the methods of extraction, hydraulic fracturing or fracking, are poisoning our aquifers. It's incredible violence to the earth. Imagine, you know, deliberately creating thousands and thousands of underground earthquakes in order to extract and pumping toxic toxins into the earth and poisoning the aquifers in order to get this stuff out. That's a clean fuel only if you're looking at it from space, right? And so much of the discussion around climate has been this astronaut's eye view. You know, we'll protect the forests and you keep polluting here. And the foundations of ecological consciousness, which are about that impulse to live in harmony with the planet and to protect, are totally lost. And so one of my wishes for Rio is that this can be a place where the so-called environmental movement comes back down to Earth from outer space. And it can once again be about land as opposed to the quote-unquote Earth. So this is a big challenge. And the challenge, as I said, is that, you know, stories have their own momentum. Now, I know this isn't just about stories. Yes, it's about corporate power. Yes, it's about political power. But stories have their own logic and their own momentum pushing us towards the conclusions that we've already imagined in every Hollywood movie that comes along and there's a savior at the end, right? And in every biblical myth, in every flattering narrative about how we are so clever that even if we haven't figured out the technological solution yet, we will, right? So let's build more dirty coal-fired plants because we are going to master carbon capture and storage. And we believe so strongly in our ability to master nature, that we have faith in technologies that do not exist. I mean, the scientists who are advocating geoengineering research most aggressively admit that they have no idea whether this can work. It's entirely untested, but the mere prospect of it is enough to derail the real conversation that we need to have, which is about putting that American way of life up for negotiation. And so how do we get out of this narrative loop? And as I said, I don't think that we do it just by saying this story is wrong, you know, just by saying no. Because actually, when you say this, we don't want an earth grab, we can't solve the problems of our ecological crisis simply with technology, we are putting our society into crisis. Now, that's a good thing because it actually is in crisis already, as we see all around us. It is the embodiment of crisis. We need to change it. But we have to understand that there's a kind of a world disintegration that happens when you challenge people's fundamental myths, their fundamental stories. And if you're going to do it, there has to be something to replace it. You know, people will not let go of these ideas unless they can see a route out of it. There's a project in the UK called Dark Mountain, and it's a group of writers and artists who are engaged in a project that they call Uncivilization. And they have an Uncivilization Manifesto where they say it is the end of our world, but it isn't the end of the world. Right? Which is very important in challenging the apocalyptic myths at the heart of Western culture, where we're assuming that just because our way of life does indeed need to change, that is catastrophe, that's the end of the world. So we need stories that tell us convincingly that even though we need to change our lives dramatically, we can enjoy this process. We can benefit from this process in deeper ways than in material ways. So we have to be not just activists in the traditional sense. We have to be storytellers. And we have to believe in those stories ourselves. And this is why I think the process that's coming out of Bolivia is so important, and why I think we all need to be supporting that process, tapping into that process,
bringing that process to our countries. Because while in the context of the official negotiations, there has been a no to this process, and Bolivia was the only country, as we know, that stood up in Cancun and said we will not ratify a rubber stamp an agreement that's going to incinerate the planet. But at the same time, Bolivia is putting forward a narrative about the rights of Mother Earth, the rights of nature, which is a fundamental challenge to the narrative that governs economic decision-making, that governs our culture, our society around the world. And so we have this alternative narrative that more than showing us that nature has rights is fundamentally based on our interdependence with nature, that our future, that our rights are bound in the rights of the natural world. We also need to tell that story that broadens this out from climate, grounds it in the earth, links the climate crisis with the broader ecological and also the broader economic crisis, because the ecological crisis happening at the same time that the financial crisis is at its peak, we need to show how these are interconnected, because of course they are. Because we have an economic model that is built on the idea of there always being more, of there always being new frontiers. But actually, we can't sustain this model because people are so impoverished around the world that they can't shop fast enough to sustain the level of growth that capitalism requires. And that's why you have these bubbles around debt, where people treat their homes like an ATM machine, their credit cards are maxed out, because they have to use debt as a tool to keep people shopping even when they can't afford it. And it is that ceaseless consumption that is, of course, at the very heart of our ecological crisis. So as we come to terms with the fact that we have hit those limits, we need to be telling stories that tell us that the world is not an endless frontier, that there is such a thing as cause and effect, that there is such a thing as physics of action and reaction, that there is such a thing as karma, whatever you want to call it. And we need these circular narratives to replace the linear narratives that have governed our societies. And I noticed that so many people here are coming from Western countries. So it's really our work. But the fact that we're here at the World Social Forum in Dakar, I think is a very good start, because we're not starting from zero. That's a little bit more good news. We're not inventing new stories, right? In so many ways, we're remembering older stories. And we need to be respecting the cultures that have done a much better job of keeping those stories alive. Whether those cultures are in Africa, whether they're in Latin America, like Bolivia, or whether they are in our own countries, in my country, Canada, where First Nations people across the country have been at the forefront of every major environmental struggle and are the reason why the oil companies and the tar sands are running scared and are having trouble laying their pipelines across British Columbia, across the United States. So we need to develop relationships of genuine solidarity, and also we need to be better students of these stories, and we need to really feel them in our bodies and in our souls, so that then we can become teachers as well and spread these messages. I think that Rio, despite the dangers embodied in the direction in which we're going, as Pat said, there are these ambitions, but they're not that prepared. They're not that prepared. They've got a lot on their plate. And the fact that we're starting this conversation now and thinking about this process of what our alternative stories can be provides us with an opportunity to turn Rio into the place where the environmental movement comes down to Earth from outer space, and where we begin to reweave the world. Thank you.
prospect of it is enough to derail the real conversation that we need to have, which is about putting that American way of life up for negotiation. And so how do we get out of this narrative loop? And as I said, I don't think that we do it just by saying this story is wrong, just by saying no. Because actually, when you say this, we don't want an earth grab, we can't solve the problems of our ecological crisis simply with technology, we are putting our society into crisis. Now, that's a good thing, because it actually is in crisis already, as we see all around us. It is the embodiment of crisis. We need to change it. But we have to understand that there's a kind of a world disintegration that happens when you challenge people's fundamental myths, their fundamental stories. And if you're going to do it, there has to be something to replace it. You know, people will not let go of these ideas unless they can see a route out of it. There's a project in the UK called Dark Mountain, and it's a group of writers and artists who are engaged in a project that they call Uncivilization. And they have an Uncivilization manifesto where they say it is the end of our world, but it isn't the end of the world, right? Which is very important in challenging the apocalyptic myths at the heart of Western culture, where we're assuming that just because our way of life does indeed need to change, that is catastrophe, that's the end of the world. So we need stories that tell us convincingly that even though we need to change our lives dramatically, we can enjoy this process. We can benefit from this process in deeper ways than in material ways. So we have to be not just activists in the traditional sense. We have to be storytellers. And we have to believe in those stories ourselves. And this is why I think the process that's coming out of Bolivia is so important, and why I think we all need to be supporting that process, tapping into that process, bringing that process to our countries. Because while in the context of the official negotiations, there has been a no to this process, and Bolivia was the only country, as we know, that stood up in Cancun and said, we will not ratify a rubber stamp an agreement that's going to incinerate the planet. But at the same time, Bolivia is putting forward a narrative about the rights of Mother Earth, the rights of nature, which is a fundamental challenge to the narrative that governs economic decision-making, that governs our culture, our society around the world. And so we have this alternative narrative that more than showing us that nature has rights is fundamentally based on our interdependence with nature, that our future, that our rights are bound in the rights of the natural world. We also need to tell that story that broadens this out from climate, grounds it in the earth, links the climate crisis with the broader ecological and also the broader economic crisis, because the ecological crisis happening at the same time that the financial crisis is at its peak, we need to show how these are interconnected, because of course they are. Because we have an economic model that is built on the idea of there always being more, of there always being new frontiers. But actually, we can't sustain this model because people are so impoverished around the world that they can't shop fast enough to sustain the level of growth that capitalism requires. And that's why you have these bubbles around debt, where people treat their homes like an ATM machine, their credit cards are maxed out, because they have to use debt as a tool to keep people shopping even when they can't afford it. And it is that ceaseless consumption that is, of course, at the very heart of our ecological crisis. So as we come to terms with the fact that we have hit those limits, we need to be telling stories
that tell us that the world is not an endless frontier, that there is such a thing as cause and effect, that there is such a thing as physics of action and reaction, that there is such a thing as karma, whatever you want to call it. And we need these circular narratives to replace the linear narratives that have governed our societies. And I noticed that so many people here are coming from Western countries. So it's really our work. But the fact that we're here at the World Social Forum in Dakar, I think is a very good start, because we're not starting from zero. That's a little bit more good news. We're not inventing new stories, right? In so many ways, we're remembering older stories. And we need to be respecting the cultures that have done a much better job of keeping those stories alive. Whether those cultures are in Africa, whether they're in Latin America, like Bolivia, or whether they are in our own countries, in my country, Canada, where First Nations people across the country have been at the forefront of every major environmental struggle and are the reason why the oil companies and the tar sands are running scared and are having trouble laying their pipelines across British Columbia, across the United States. So we need to develop relationships of genuine solidarity, and also we need to be better students of these stories. And we need to really feel them in our bodies and in our souls, so that then we can become teachers as well and spread these messages. I think that Rio, despite the dangers embodied in the direction in which we're going, as Pat said, there are these ambitions, but they're not that prepared. They're not that prepared. They've got a lot on their plate. And the fact that we're starting this conversation now and thinking about this process of what our alternative stories can be provides us with an opportunity to turn Rio into the place where the environmental movement comes down to Earth from outer space and where we begin to reweave the world. Thank you.
Yeah. Mama, mama, mama. Mama Africa, oh.
Mama Africa.
You have been listening to a presentation by author Naomi Klein, given in Dakar, Senegal, at the World Social Forum in 2011, focusing on climate justice struggles globally and the importance of confronting state and corporate attempts at geoengineering the planet in the face of climate change. Music in this report by McCann Jay of Senegal. This interview has been produced for broadcast on campus and community radio by Stefan Christoph. Yeah.